You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we have a Thanksgiving-themed small wonder with Jim Skop. But first, a new national poll shows South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg pulling into second place in the race for the White House. The poll, released by Quinnipiac University yesterday, put former Vice President Joe Biden on top with 24% support among Democratic voters and independent voters who lean left. Buttigieg received 16%, pulling ahead of Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who saw her support fall by half. She stands at 14% and is almost tied with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, we try not to get too wrapped up in the polls, but it's encouraging to continue to see that momentum. You know, we felt it on the ground for some time, began to see it reflected in the early states, and encouraging that that's being reflected nationally, too.
And that's South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who addressed a crowd of supporters last night at West Middle School in Sioux City. Here's some more of what Buttigieg had to say about his plans for the future if he could be elected president of the United States.
The sun's going to come up over a divided nation. We will be even more torn up over politics and exhausted from fighting and polarized than we are now. With everything that we've been through, everything we're about to go through, we will be very much in need of being brought together and unified. That's one of the two huge tasks facing the next president. But as if that weren't challenging enough, at the same time, we also have to face these huge issues that help explain how we got to this point in the first place. Problems that didn't take a break for the impeachment process or the Trump presidency to begin with. We're still going to have an economy where, sure, the Dow Jones is looking good, but a lot of our communities and families and households are being left behind. We're still going to have a climate that is getting closer each passing day to a point of no return that could be catastrophic for a future generation. We're still going to have a gun violence epidemic in this country that has kids getting active shooter drills before they even learn to read. And that will cry out for urgent action from the next president of the United States. So what I'm asking you to consider is the weight of the job that will be necessary, but also the kind of president we're going to need. A president who can deliver bold action to deal with those big problems right away, and at the same time, figure out a way to do it that's actually going to leave us as a country more unified, not polarized, than we were before. That is the president that I am running to be. And that is what I'm asking for your support in bringing about, to be the president who can help our country pick up the pieces, move toward real action, solve our problems with big ideas, and be unified. And while that's not exactly easy, I see a way to do it. And the way to do it begins with the values that bind us together as Americans. Because properly understood, these values also guide us toward real forward-leaning action. I'm talking about values like our love of our country, like patriotism. But I'm not talking about the cheap nationalism of a president who hugs the flag on his way to stage, or thinks it's okay to pardon a war criminal, thinks that's pro-military, when that is nothing but a swipe against the honor of those who serve in uniform. The kind of cheap nationalism to tell some people they don't belong in this country based on the language they speak at home or what they look like. I am not talking about that. I'm talking about a richer, deeper love of country that begins with the understanding that our country is made of people. And you can't love a country if you hate half of the people in it. We got to do better than that. We got to honor the flag in terms of what it actually represents, the values that that flag stands for. And there's something real at stake in the meaning of that flag. Matter of fact, part of what it stands for is a sense of duty that means when somebody speaks out about wrongdoing in Congress at the highest level of our government, they deserve to be protected because they are expressing their loyalty to the republic for which it stands when they speak out. But also, if we mean business about protecting this country, that means we're protecting each other. And that starts right here at home, before we even get to the things that need to change in the way that we protect this country overseas. Let's talk about what it means to protect each other. That starts by making sure that we protect each other from gun violence and see to it that the Second Amendment can't be confused with an excuse to do nothing at all when even Republicans and the vast majority of gun owners know that we need universal background checks, red flag laws, and other measures to save lives in our community. That is a matter of national security, too. And national security means protecting our future. We cannot go on with the climate moving in a direction that will deny opportunities to generations of young people. That is why we've got to act in the name of security, to treat climate change like the security crisis that it is, and lead the world in doing something about it, because this problem will not be fixed without American leadership.
That's South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg at a town hall Wednesday night at West Middle School. You can hear Mayor Pete's full opening speech, plus his answers to questions from some of those who attended the town hall. Go to our website, kwit.org. Democratic candidate for president and former mayor of San Antonio, Julian Castro, visited Sioux City over the weekend. Castro was a member of President Obama's cabinet. He met with leaders of the Siouxland Pride Alliance and addressed issues impacting the LGBTQ community, including homelessness, conversion therapy, and discrimination. He was also asked about his priorities for his first 100 days in office if he were to win the presidential election.
And this is where I think my experience, my executive experience as a cabinet member, will come in very handy, which is that during the transition period after the election, I want a catalog of all of the administrative changes, the rules that have been passed in EPA or HUD or Department of Education and so forth, Health and Human Services, all of the executive orders, all of the administrative actions that have been done by the Trump administration, and then identify the priority ones that we need to change immediately back to the way they were, at least under President Obama, if not make them stronger and better. This includes what they've done with transgender rights. That's right. And in healthcare, in housing. The military, in housing. They've turned back the administrative action that we took, the transgender rule. So I want a catalog of all of those things across the departments. On the first day, immediately that afternoon, I would instruct the acting secretaries, because of course we won't have our secretaries appointed on the first day, I'll instruct the acting secretaries to immediately begin the process of moving forward to undo the damage that the president has done. And that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of stuff there. I would also immediately reverse executive orders like the Muslim travel ban, the Remain in Mexico policy, family separation, the transgender military ban, all of those that have received a lot of attention. Legislatively, or one other executive order is rejoining the Paris Climate Accord. Immediately, we would send a signal to our allies and our adversaries around the world that we're going to lead again on sustainability. And then, you know, part of the first 100 days of legislation would be a Green New Deal to follow that up, to try and get to net zero and to create a lot of economic opportunity in this country. On top of that, I would move forward with healthcare. I believe in a system where we base it off of Medicare. We strengthen Medicare for the people who are on it. We expand it to the people who want it. We lower prescription drug prices with patent reform and also direct negotiation between the federal government and these pharmaceutical companies. We allow for the importation of drugs to this country from countries that vet them well, like Canada, for instance. And also, though, that if somebody has a strong, solid private health insurance plan, that we allow for people to also have that. But under my version, people would opt out of that. So Medicare would be the default. Instead of a public option, it's like a private option, essentially. And I believe that we can accomplish that so that we base it off Medicare, but then also allow a choice. What I agree with Bernie and Elizabeth on is that too oftentimes with these private health insurance plans, what happens is that, you know, you think you have a good plan, and then you actually have to use it. And then they tell you that you're not covered. So if we're going to allow for private health insurance, we need to make sure that it hits certain benchmarks where it's solid so that when you need it, you get it. If we can do that, we can accomplish both that Medicare-based system and choice. That's what I believe in. So I would do that. And finally, in the first, you know, we're talking about, you know, some of the first 100 days work, we would also do immigration reform. because I think that one of the opportunities we missed early on in 09, 010 was getting immigration reform done. And I think that we need to end his cruelty. And that in and of itself will improve the lives of a lot of people.
Candidate Castro was also questioned about his stance on the Iowa caucuses. He recently said Iowa doesn't have enough diversity to represent the rest of the country. A school counselor in Sioux City told Castro that isn't the case.
But you said that Iowa should not be first in the nation to caucus because we're not diverse enough. And I kind of take that to heart because I feel we are very diverse. Right. We're sitting in here talking about all the diverse issues that affect us day in and day out. And I don't care if we affect one student with that issue or one of those diverse issues. It's important to us and it matters to us. So I kind of take an affront to what you said and what you said. And so I just would like you to speak to it as well.
No, and thank you for being honest about that. I appreciate it. First of all, that's not anything personal against the people of Iowa or New Hampshire. In fact, I said when I made those comments that, you know, I have no complaints about how we've been received in the state. Everybody has been, you know, nice and fantastic. And I also didn't say that there's no diversity in Iowa or New Hampshire. There is some. But I think that when you compare that to many, many other states in our country, that the diversity in all of the ways that you just mentioned in other states dwarfs the diversity that is existent in Iowa and New Hampshire. I'll give you a good example of that. I think I've been asked more times about ethanol in Iowa than I have about mass transit. People who need to take the bus for a living, you know? And so the mix of issues that you get, I think, can be broader in other states. And just the diversity that's reflected in the community in some of these other states. And then finally, I mean, I just think that, you know, like our country has changed a lot since 1972, and our Democratic Party has changed a lot, and that we should give other states an opportunity to go first. The thing that I really respect about the folks of Iowa and New Hampshire is that y'all take it very seriously. You know, you take your role in this process seriously. I was telling somebody today that in most places, when people show up, like at your rally or your event, you know, they support you, you know, right? But in Iowa and New Hampshire, people will go to 10 people's rallies. Right? Like they listen to folks. Right?
Guilty.
Which is, yeah, I mean, but that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I credit the folks here in Iowa for doing that, for vetting the candidates. I also believe, though, that the people of any state, if they were to go first for 50 years, would do that as well, that you would have that kind of culture of vetting the candidates. I think that what should happen, in my mind, is at the DNC, people of different states, different backgrounds should get together, and they should actually rank order these states according to how much they reflect the diversity of the Democratic Party and the country. They should also put in points based on whether that state has adopted certain electoral reforms, early voting, access for people with disabilities to voting sites. One of the complaints that I've heard over and over in this state is from people with disabilities because it's hard to get out to the caucus, especially if it's snowing on caucus night. There is no early voting for caucus, for the caucus. You get one chance. If somebody has to work a shift, if you're a worker and you have to work a shift at 7 o'clock on February 3rd, there's no way for you to make, you know, your voice heard. So I think there's tremendous change that needs to happen. And yeah, I decided to tell the truth as I see it, you know. And I did, when I did that, by the way, I was here in Iowa. So I was not, you know, I was not in Texas or I wasn't in New York, I wasn't in California. I wanted to do that here in Iowa to let people know that even though I'm here, like I'm telling you all the truth as I see it. Now I know that people can have their different arguments about whether that's the way we should go. But I also think during this time that you have a lot of people, right, including a lot of candidates, who won't tell you what they actually think on that issue. I mean, do you think that I'm the only candidate that's running that believes that? No. But I'm the one that'll say that, because I think that ultimately we do need to make reforms. And again, that's not any kind of personal judgment. That's just what I believe that we need to do so that other states have an opportunity to have their shot.
That's Julian Castro, one of many Democrats running for the party's nomination for the presidential election. A recent poll showed likely caucus goers gave Castro less than 1% support in the Iowa caucuses. That's Julian Castro, one of the many Democrats running for the party's nomination for the presidential election. A recent poll showed that likely caucus goers gave Castro less than 1% support for the Iowa caucuses that will take place Monday, February 3rd. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Last week, the House impeachment hearings wrapped up on the inquiry into possible wrongdoing by President Donald Trump. Several witnesses claimed that Trump had asked the Ukraine for help looking into the activities of former Vice President and presidential candidate Joe Biden and his son in exchange for military aid. Siouxland Democratic Senate candidate Michael Franken is a retired three-star admiral who served three presidents. He and four other candidates are vying for the opportunity to compete against Republican Senator Joni Ernst in next fall's general election. Franken says President Trump's actions harmed relations with Ukraine and benefited Trump himself.
But tossing in a last-minute caveat, especially caveats that are clearly benefiting a single individual over national objectives, is frankly deplorable. And it is a pollution of the system, which we've historically been highly critical of.
Franken says the Senate should be prepared to vote on the impeachment of President Trump. Des Moines Democratic Senate candidate Eddie Morrow says Trump should be impeached for his behavior.
And whether it was a quid pro quo or not, in my opinion, isn't the measuring stick of what we have here. What we have is a president and other people surrounding him reaching out to a foreign government, asking for dirt, basically, on a political rival. And everybody, Democrats and Republicans alike, should be standing up and saying that is not acceptable in this country.
There are three other Democrats, besides Franken and Morrow, who are running for an opportunity to challenge Joni Ernst in next year's general election. The primary is next spring. Siouxland Public Media has reached out to Senator Ernst for comment. Senator Ernst has said she would like to see the impeachment process play through. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mary Hartnett. The search for a replacement for the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, Mark Cady, will start soon. Cady died unexpectedly of a heart attack on November 15th at the age of 66. Cady served on the state's high court for 21 years. Retired federal judge Mark Bennett, who served on the bench in Sioux City, is currently the director of the Institute for Justice Reform and Innovation at Drake Law School. Bennett was a friend of Chief Justice Cady and talked to Siouxland Public Media about Cady's legacy and his thoughts on the process for appointing a new justice for the Iowa Supreme Court. State law recently changed to allow the governor to appoint a majority of the members to that nominating committee.
there are so many things about him that are so important. But the main thing is that he was always so kind and gracious and considerate and concerned about everybody he met in life, no matter what your station in life was. He was just as kind to the a person who cleaned the courthouse building as to other chief justices from courts around the country. And he's certainly the most iconic judge or justice ever in Iowa. But also nationally, I'm not sure most people understand how revered he was nationally. And so he was the current president of the National Conference of Chief Justices, which are made up, it's a group made up of every chief justice from the state Supreme Court, so all 50 states, the District of Columbia, the territories, the Commonwealth, and they elected Mark Cady from Iowa as their president. So he was kind of known as the chief of chiefs. And, you know, he was a great legal scholar and a wonderful jurist. But I think people who knew him will remember him most for his kindness and his dedication to family and public service.
He's also an alumni of Drake as well, so I'm assuming that you have had a long history with him.
Yes. He graduated, I think, 3 years after I did. He was also a Drake undergraduate, and he's just such a, has been a wonderful representative of Drake Law School, and he's been a fabulous alum. Just such a wonderful human being. And his judicial career was so amazing because he became a judge at age 29. And he started off as an associate district judge in 1983, then became a district court judge in 86, then went to the Court of Appeals in 1994, became chief judge of the Court of Appeals, then went on the Iowa Supreme Court, really shortly after that, I think it's just about 2 years after he was on the Iowa Court of Appeals, and then in 2011 became Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. No one in the history of Iowa has served at every level like Mark Cady did, and I predict nobody ever will. It's just such an astonishing career that I just can't believe anybody could ever duplicate that.
And David Wiggins will be the acting Chief Justice.
David was a classmate of mine, too, at Drake, yeah.
I know that there's been some talk and concern just the way the state of Iowa changed the law on how people are on that nominating commission, the state judicial nominating commission.
Well, I know there's some controversy about it, but I think it's best to wait and see how the commission does. They've done an extraordinary job in the past. Iowa judges in the state court system, we have tremendous, tremendous women and men who serve in the Iowa judiciary, and they've all been very well qualified. And I'm sure the commission will pick some exceptionally well qualified people. Nobody can fill Justice Cady's spot, but, you know, that spot needs to be filled. And I'm sure the commission will recommend highly qualified Iowa lawyers and judges for the governor to consider. So, yeah, there have been some changes in the way it's picked, and but I think we need to give the new system some time and see if it works as well as the old system, and I'm optimistic that it will.
And then the governor will make a choice. Is there concern that the court will move more to the right now since she is a Republican governor?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the court has moved to the right with the tragic a loss of my dear, dear, dear friend, Justice Darrell Hecht, you know, from Sioux City, and now Justice Cady. So, you know, it's definitely going to move to the right. How far to the right remains to be seen. But, you know, let me say something about that. Yes, there are some, you know, I think it's fair to say conservative justices on the Iowa Supreme Court. Several are really good friends of mine, and they're people of great integrity, really incredible intellect, and they're doing everything they can to call the cases the way they see them. So, you know, elections do have consequences, and that's kind of a consequence of the election, but I'm pretty sure that whoever gets appointed will be very well qualified.
That's retired federal judge Mark Bennett, who's currently with Drake Law School in Des Moines. A representative for the Iowa Supreme Court says a date hasn't yet been set for the nominating committee to take applications for the open seat on the Iowa Supreme Court. Once the application process starts, the committee will have 60 days to gather applications. Then Governor Kim Reynolds will select the new justice out of three finalists picked by the committee.
All right, this right here is called Gobble Gobble Turkey Wobble. You're gonna wanna be wobbling right now. Get your wobble ready.
Put your foot out and you flap those wings. You bring your foot back and you shake that thing. Put your foot out and you flap those wings.
Yes, it is Thanksgiving week, and you may not be doing the Gobble Gobble Turkey Wobble, but most of us will be eating a holiday meal with family and friends. This year, with all the polarizing political issues and candidates, some of us fear getting caught up in a political squabble at the table. Mary Lee Brock of Creighton University has some advice on how to avoid that kind of conflict. She's the assistant director of Creighton's Negotiation and Conflict Resolution Program. Brock says it's important to remember that a lot of this heated discussion is driven by emotion and not hard facts, so it can be difficult to be reasonable.
We say we value facts and figures and rationality, and it's not true. These are emotional issues, although they're framed in kind of black and white facts. And it requires some reflection and some vulnerability to start to get at the emotional part of it. And that's hard to do, and it's exhausting, and it can be really risky. So I can see why we oftentimes don't get at the real heart of the matter.
You say we really need to show some understanding for other people's feelings and opinions.
Right. And I think that can be done and still be true to our own perspectives and our own values. It's not like I would ever ask anyone to accept something that's so challenging or so different than what they might hold near and dear, but at least to show it can help to show some compassion that the other person feels strongly, that they're coming on so strong. And a lot of times those the people that are very provocative are actually kind of making almost a preemptive strike. They're afraid. They're trying to protect some form of identity or sense of what they hope a community would be. And so they're acting out of fear, although they act like they might be, a champion debater. And so just to even have some compassion for the challenges that someone that is coming on so strong could be facing.
Another thing is sometimes it's hard for people to do is to extend their curiosity about how this other people thinks and what they believe.
Right. Yeah. This is my profession, and I've been teaching and studying conflict for over 20 years. And I still, when it's about me, I still can feel those hooks and triggers and feel that emotional, visceral response. So I always urge people, when that happens, don't feel shame or don't feel like you're being defeated, but just notice it. And then decide, what do you want to do with that? Are you there to keep family connections? Are you there to contribute to family traditions? Or are you there to kind of win a debate? And sometimes those two, maintaining traditions and winning debate might be mutually exclusive.
You say you need to be true to your own perspective, but also sometimes you just got to let some things go.
Right. Exactly. And I think I think people might hesitate to do that because they're worried that means that they are supporting the other perspective or they weren't honorable to what they believe is near and dear. And it's just really thinking about what are your goals. And if this is a chapter in a long family history, kind of letting it go might be okay. And staying curious and letting the other person, when you hit that right acknowledgement and let someone know you understand they feel strongly about it, you might see kind of a a relaxation in them, and like, okay, they might back away from that desire to prove their point at all cost.
One question I've wanted to ask people who either, you know, support one of the Democrats or support the president, I've wanted to try this out and say, okay, I know that you have a lot of problems with this person, but is there one thing about him or one thing he has done that you can point to and say that was a good thing?
Right. I really like that perspective, and it kind of helps build some common ground, because they're, you know, like looking at, yeah, just seeing where are some contributions. Is there one aspect of accomplishment or approach or choices that could be celebrated or at least accepted as something that was good?
Well, also, you know, we need to take the long view, because you don't want to have an ongoing war with somebody in your family over this fleeting political situation.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, it's, again, that war is often fueled by fear that, you know, that someone is coming on so strong, or what impact is this going to have on my children? Or you might be introducing a new partner, or people might be feeling vulnerable. They may have had a change in status, someone recently divorced or widowed, you know, all these kinds of complicating factors as we continually redefine what family is. And yeah, take the long view and realize that there's some resiliency in a family. And if children hear some very difficult things to hear, then just, you don't have to condone it, but just use it as a teaching moment later on. And talk about the feelings that child had hearing those kinds of things, the reaction, what might happen differently, what can we learn from this? So it's, I think sometimes we kind of just drop into the meal, but if we can do some pre-work before, reflect upon our goals and how we want to behave, and then do some reflection afterwards. Where were the bright points in the encounter? What are some things I would do differently? What did I learn? How can I be compassionate? And it just, that kind of helps that keep it in a bigger perspective.
It does seem like the rules are different now, because when I was a kid, and we'd have dinners and people over, and sometimes people would bring up politics or something that was going on that everyone didn't agree on. The rule, whoever was making the dinner said, okay, we're not going to talk about politics, and we're not going to talk about religion, and we're not going to talk about it while we're sitting at this table. And you know what? People actually agreed, and they didn't do it.
Right. Yeah. And now, yeah, I think part of it is just we're still in a transition of how we communicate. So it's, there's so much online and anonymity with that, and immediacy, and just kind of some support of various viewpoints if you seek it out. So yeah, just to look at ground rules, and maybe it's time to kind of think about revisiting that, you know, what do we collectively want this dinner to be? Or also just doing some pre-planning, like, I've been at dinner gatherings with friends or family where they had some fun trivia cards or something to kind of redirect the energy. So still get some conversation flowing, but rather than just having a blank slate, a topic, and the first thing that comes to mind is let's debate politics, like look at other types of topics, thinking about favorite family memories, looking at, you know, what's your bucket list for trips, you know, just thinking about being creative and developing some conversation starters. It's kind of becoming a lost art form, but it can be captured easily again. And wouldn't that be neat to hear the young kids thinking about where they'd like to travel, or what, you know, their perspective of various memories, or a relative that maybe has passed. You know, those, it can be, there could be some really dynamic conversations on a totally different topic.
And the kids get pretty bored with that political talk, to tell you the truth. I've heard them mention that. It's like, are we going to talk about this all day? You know, they don't enjoy it.
Yeah. And it's like, it, maybe someone is, you know, really pounding their political views because they want to make sure that they're establishing their role as the, you know, head of the family or patriarch. So they could still have that role and be a leader in kind of sharing memories or stories, or looking at ancestry, and just all kinds of exciting opportunities. And then that gives a chance for everybody to learn from one another.
Since 2016, a lot of us have sort of gone into our own little political world in that we don't want to talk about politics with anyone other than those we agree with or that are on the same page as we are.
Yeah, and that's, you know, just looking at maybe it would be a relief to a lot of people to say this, you know, here are the parameters, here are the ground rules. And I think what's, as I've reflected upon these political discussions, it, so much of it has become about personalities and kind of just really deep values. The policy questions are so complex, it's very difficult to discuss those. And most of us don't have the true, you know, or deep information and perspective to even ably discuss these policy things. So it kind of devolves to a personality contest, and that's not very helpful either. Well, and the number one response to conflict in our society and in the U.S. is avoidance. We tend to avoid conflict. And so then it doesn't really have anywhere to go. So we avoid it in generally two ways. One is just ignoring it completely and just thinking eventually this will go away. The other way to avoid conflict is with these very hard, declarative, bombastic statements. It sounds like that's being really assertive or aggressive, but it's actually avoiding conflict because it doesn't allow any space to talk about what's truly important.
That was Mary Lee Brock. She's the assistant director of Creighton University's Negotiation and Conflict Resolution Program. We talked about some strategies that might help avoid some bad arguments at the Thanksgiving or holiday table this year. Listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. An art exhibit in Sioux City asks a simple question on the surface. What does it mean to be an American? As Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer reports, this rare art initiative showcases a diverse dialogue for people living in Siouxland.
Looking for America Siouxland features works by a dozen artists at the Betty Strong Encounter Center. The pieces include photos, mixed media, graphic design.
It's a pig.
Whole Hog by Rich Yates shows parts of the animal with words sometimes used to describe others, like them, different, deviant,
other people,
strange.
Right? Even though we're still part of this whole community, and again, which the pig represents for us.
One of a handful of paintings includes a John Deere tractor, others abstract thoughts. With a simple theme.
What does America mean to you?
Good question.
At a special gathering to launch the exhibit, Christine McAvoy snaps pictures of some of the women whose faces cover nearly a full wall.
Actually, I am the lone photographer in this exhibit. The women that I photographed are women from a mentoring group called Emerging Women's Voices. We meet every single Tuesday, and we become a very close-knit group of individuals. I wanted to photograph them, and when I first broached the subject, everybody was like, oh, no, I don't want to have my picture taken. And so I slowly wore them down and started photographing the women. And once they saw the results, then they were willing to be photographed. And so it's been a great journey. I wanted to photograph them how I see them. I see them as strong women. I see them as interesting women. I see them as great contributions to our community.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the women in the photographs?
Well, the women come from all over. We have women on the wall that represent East Africa. We have women that are from Pakistan, from Central America, Jamaica. There's just a plethora of women that are represented.
One of the images shows a young teen smiling in a sea of multicolored basketballs.
My name is Zakia. I am 15 years old and I go to North High School. I feel like I like it because it kind of stands me out because you never seen like a Muslim girl playing basketball.
Zakia is Ethiopian, born in Kenya before moving to the U.S.
I came here when I was about 6 months. My mom was very new to this country and everything. It was hard for her to, like, you know, attract to it and everything.
Do you think this is a community that embraces diversity?
Yes, I've been living in the city for 6 years now. Now we have different kind of countries that are coming here. I feel like the city changed and became more open.
There's room for all of these different
Dan Wallace is the director of projects for New American Economy, a bipartisan research and advocacy organization based in New York City.
Because what we're doing is we're asking people, what does it mean to be American in your community? And so we wanted to have answers to that question come from lots of different kinds of places.
Sioux City is one of only six communities across the country chosen for this art initiative, with the goal of bringing people of different backgrounds and beliefs together.
So when we were thinking about where to go, what we really wanted most was to have geographic diversity, demographic diversity, political diversity. And so on our way here, we've already stopped in Detroit, Michigan, Salt Lake City, Utah, Anchorage, Alaska. This is our fourth stop. We're going on to El Paso, Texas, and then to Northwest Arkansas. We've worked really closely with an organization called One Siouxland for the last couple of years.
When they called and said, hey, do you want to do it? I was like, absolutely.
Erica De Leon, I'm the director of One Siouxland.
So One Siouxland, about 2 years ago, was awarded a Gateways for Growth grant, which is really looking at the economic impact of immigrants and refugees on our community, looking at things like tax dollars, business started, jobs filled, things like that. And as part of that, then building a strategic plan to be a more welcoming and inclusive community. We've gotten so far away from civil discourse in this country in a lot of instances that it's really become important for us to get back to looking at each other as human, not as a Republican or a Democrat or whatever we label people.
Do you think Sioux City does enough to embrace diversity and people from different backgrounds?
Well, I think in general we're really good at that because we're Midwest and we have big hearts and we like to welcome people. But I think one of the big things is just understanding and getting to know people rather than listening to what we hear on the national news. If we would all, you know, maybe turn the national news off and really just go outside and talk to each other and get to know each other a little bit better, I think that that's probably one of the best ways we can connect with anybody, regardless of what country they're from.
A sentiment echoed by those participating, including photographer Christine McAvoy.
What does America mean to you?
The biggest thing, I think, is acceptance.
In Sioux City, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
When people see these images, I hope that they accept these women. I hope that people accept me for all of my strengths and my weaknesses and my idiosyncrasies, because there are so many places in the world where if you are one way or another, if you are a woman or your sexual orientation or the color of your skin or your religion, you are not safe in that nation. And this is a nation that everybody should be able to be who they are, their true self.
The exhibit, Looking for America's Siouxland, will be at the Betty Strong Encounter Center at the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center through the end of the year.
When I was in school, you know, we used to sing it something like this. Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of gray. Far purple mountain majesties. Talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. He crowned that good. Save it, brotherhood, from sea to...
On this Thanksgiving, Jim Scott recalls the story of two friends, enemies in war, but brothers in spirit. Two friends, each who gave help to the other when it was most needed and almost too difficult to ask for.
Come harvest. Otto faces a crucial shortage of help. Hired men are not to be found. Some are off to the South Pacific, some to Europe. Harvest holds enough anxiety as it is, but how he'll get his crop in without enough help is enough to keep him awake at all hours. So many men are gone that church music sounds like a women's chorus. Down the road, there's a POW camp where hundreds, even thousands, of young men don't do much at all. The government puts out a shingle, and Otto Steinke, whose mom never really learned English at all, decides to take a chance on the enemy, so to speak. So he goes down the road to the POW camp, and he asks for a few young men. It's harvest, after all, and they're needed. One of the men who, under guard, comes to his farm is named Becker. A prisoner of war, Steinke discovers rather quickly is hardly a Hitler fan. Becker had been conscripted. He hated the way his country was treated after the Great War. But once they started working, to Otto Steinke, this man, Becker, doesn't feel so much like an enemy. It's very strange at first. And then, not. When harvest is over, Becker stays on. Otto can use the help around the farm, and he's working ground down the road for neighbors also. Although he and Becker are circumspect about using their German language in public, when the two of them are together in the barn or in the shed, they communicate like brothers in the old country. When finally the war in Europe ends, the two are friends, so much so that when Becker is returned to Germany, as all POWs had to be, some tears fall in the Steinke home. Write us for sure, Otto's wife says on that last day. If something there is what you need, let us know. And Becker nods. But the Germany Becker discovers when back home is not the Germany he left. The country is ravaged. When he leaves the bombed out cities, he's surprised and he is blessed to find his house out in the country, still intact, his family safe. But the economy is in shambles. No work, no money, no food. One day, Becker decides to see for himself if what his wife has told him in the dead of night is true. When the Allies came, they forced everyone from town to see what Hitler had done to those he hated, she told him. The death camp was hidden away in a forest not all that far away. She won't tell him exactly what she saw. She didn't have to. When he comes to the camp, there are no bodies, no starving prisoners, no children. Still, when he walks in, the suffering that somehow lingered there, he can see and smell. It will infect you, he tells himself. Even what's not there could kill you, just imagining. Write us, sure, Otto's wife had told him. If something there is what you need, let us know. But he can't do that. In Iowa, he was treated like an honored guest. Here in this place where he is standing, he knows exactly what his wife would not describe. That people here were treated like vermin, that they died from nothing to eat. He doesn't dare to write the Steinkes. He is so greatly ashamed. When he returns, his wife comforts him, but tells him to sit down and write his American friends, not for his sake, nor for hers, nor for Germany's, but for the children, because they are suffering, really, really suffering. Can't you see? He can. So he does write. And in the letter, he tells Otto what his wife saw and what he did, even though there were no people there. And then he asks, "And relief comes as he knew it would. 10 packages, food, clothes, chocolate, and things impossible to get." Becker and his family, or so the story goes, were filled with thanksgiving.
Today's Small Wonder is based on a story collected by Linda Betzinger McCann in Prisoners of War in Iowa. Support for Small Wonders on Siouxland Public Media comes from the Daniels Osborne Law Firm in the Ho-Chunk Center in downtown Sioux City, serving the needs of clients in real estate transactions, business formation and guidance, and personal estate planning. More information is available on Facebook or at danielsosborne.com. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you have a great holiday week. I'm Mary Hartnett. That's it for The Exchange. We'll see you next week.